as I mentioned at the top of the day, we've got a slight departure from the promoted agenda. Only slight departure, though. We have with us today, and for the entirety of today's forum, Mary Mallett, who is the CEO of DANA, the Disability Advocacy Network Australia. And perhaps, Mary, you could even do a little bit of a spruik about the work of DANA when you have the microphone. Given that we have so many inquiries and investigations going on, either at a federal level or at a Vic state level, regarding especially the matter of abuse and neglect of people with disability, I thought it would be very opportune, given that Mary is here in Melbourne, to give her some airtime to speak to the NDIS safeguards and... Quality and Safeguards Framework. And Mary is very keen to hear from disability advocates. So without further ado, I'll hand over to Mary, and in about half an hour, I'll take the microphone again and we'll talk about the advertised agenda item. Thanks.
Thanks very much. And this, I'm a late addition to the agenda because I had to come down to Melbourne for something that's on tomorrow around the outcomes framework for the NDIS meeting that's on at the airport, and so I thought if I came a day early I could come to this as well, and I just want to pick your brains briefly. So before I ask you some questions, I'll just quickly, first of all, DANA is the peak body for advocacy. We're a tiny national peak based in Canberra. We were defunded 2 days before Christmas by the federal government, and we so the money was to run out at the end of February. The funding, there was enough pressure put on to have it extended till the end of June. So currently our certainty of funding is only till the end of June this year, and we don't know what's going to happen after that. There is some, the minister has said, maybe some capacity building funding. There were about eight peak bodies, peak disability bodies that were defunded. It includes Inclusion Australia for intellectual disability, Deaf Australia, Blind Citizens, all the disability-specific peaks plus DANA, the advocacy peak, were all defunded. And there's a new model that the department, DSS, have view as the appropriate model now, which is a smaller number of peaks. And, you know, we don't think it's right, but the organisations that got funded are all good organisations. That includes WIDA, Children with Disabilities Australia, PWDA, who are based in Sydney, NIDA, National Ethnic Disability Association, and Alliance, at least, and First Peoples Disability Network for Aboriginal people with disability. So they're all good organisations, but it doesn't replace the voices that will be missing. Anyway, we're so separately trying to deal with that issue. Before I go on to the quality and safeguarding, I will just mention the... So, Robin had... There were some copies of papers that some of you will have picked up, and I've just picked up the last one that was on the desk outside, and it just, on the front page of it, mentions the quality and safeguarding framework consultation, and inside it talks about the Senate inquiry into violence, abuse and neglect. And I'll just touch on that first, because that's got a very short submission timeline. So there are, you've got a Victorian ombudsman investigation happening, and I think another parliamentary inquiry in Victoria. So I'm presuming many of you will be preparing material anyway to go into those. Well, you could use the same, exactly the same material, really, and put it into the Senate, put it in as a submission to the Senate inquiry. The closing date is the 10th of April, which isn't very far after Easter. There will be hearings in every state and territory, but they haven't set the dates for those yet. In particular, I'd like to highlight, I know people who are working in the advocacy sector will have things to say about every one of the terms of reference, but one of the terms of reference is the role and challenges of formal and informal disability advocacy in preventing and responding to violence, abuse and neglect against people with disability. Now, we managed to get that. There wasn't in the original terms of reference. That wasn't in there. We managed to get that in, so we hope people will respond by telling people about the advocacy issues. All the other terms of reference, of course, are around all of the violence and abuse issues. So, quality and safeguarding. The NDIS is... It's actually, the work is being done by DSS. So it's a confused picture, really. The NDIA are the organisation that runs the NDIS. But the policy is set by the federal department, DSS. So they're the people doing this work. The NDIA, once the policy framework set, NDIA will then implement it. So this is the consultation document. There's a website which is called engage.dss.gov.au. So this is it's a phenomenally new thing for a federal department to be wanting to engage with anybody. And they have so they've but and this is the very their very first go at it. And it's there's lots of surprising things about it. So they haven't done too bad a job. If you look up engage.dss.gov.au, you can get the paper off it. They've set up, so you can make a submission, you can download the paper. They did an easy read version as well. They've got a discussion forum on there, which they are very distressed because almost nobody has responded. Is anybody here from DSS, actually? Anyway, so what they thought in their naivety is they thought that all they had to do was create a discussion forum, put it up on this new website, and that they'd be flooded with all of us wanting to put posts on their discussion forum. And they've only had maybe 16 posts altogether on all the different topics. And they had people sitting there waiting, you know, to moderate all the posts. But you have to go on and make a post, you have to register. So they've put a barrier immediately in the way of people thinking, well, yes, I'll go and do that. And anyway, it's just not what people do. So I am explaining to them that instead of what their response is likely to be is just shut it down and never do it again. I'm trying to explain to them, yes, you have to build up over a period of time in people's minds that, yes, you can engage with the federal government in this way, and yes, they'll listen. And anyway, so if you're doing submissions and you've had a look at their engage.dss.gov.au, make a little bit of effort to praise them for the attempt. They'll respond to that, I think. So the quality and safeguarding framework. So the other thing they've got on there, they've got the consultation paper and the easy English version, and there are fact sheets about each aspect of it. So, of course, there's quality and safeguarding all over the country. Every state and territory already has their own systems. But what they're trying to do is develop a nationally consistent framework, which is not an easy thing to do. And what they've got in the paper is they've got options for each aspect. The options vary from the lightest of everything, the light touch way of doing things, which would be less than exists currently in any state or territory. And so they've put in, for most things, they've got three or four options varying from the light touch through to what they see as the top of the range. Now, the top of the range, to be honest, is mostly what already exists, especially in Victoria. And there's a big difference, actually, in some of these areas between what's available and the surrounding systems around the complaints mechanisms and, you know, the states that have disability commissioners, senior practitioners. You know, they're very different environments. And in Victoria, you probably have a pre-existing set of systems that you have more than there is really anywhere else. Now, and I know that doesn't mean that in Victoria the system's perfect. I know that. That's why it's a worry if they try and dilute it. So I suppose what I would be suggesting to everybody who's operating in Victoria is it's important to tell them that all of those systems that are in place are necessary and important. That's if you think they are. Now, if you think some of them are completely useless and perform no useful function, Mark is laughing in case everybody says the community visitors are no good or something, then you tell them how you see it. But what we expect from the advocacy sector, you know, of course, people are going to say, yes, there may be problems with the current systems, but they're necessary. That's, you know, the likely response. So they divide things in this quality and safeguarding framework in developmental. They have divided them into three domains. Developmental, the middle one is something that's gone out of my head, and corrective, preventative. Developmental, preventative, and corrective. The other astounding thing and I hope as many of you can, do print this paper off and read it, and at the very least, do a search function and see how many times you find the word advocacy. Twice. Yep, yep. So advocacy, this is the most astounding thing about the quality and safeguarding framework from the people who do this every day, is that advocacy is in here as, they call it an enabler. But we're listed as an enabler underneath the actual jigsaw puzzle that is quality and safeguarding, and we're listed there along with the UNCRPD. And when we've tackled them about this, they say that's because advocacy won't be funded out of the NDIS. Advocacy as it exists now will continue to be funded. DSS, the Commonwealth Government, isn't intending to not fund it. So it'll still sit there as a program. So they don't have to think about it. Therefore, they don't have to think about it. They don't write about it. Obviously, we have to, and hopefully the rest of you will also highlight to them that it's important. And because the worry is that if it doesn't get written up and talked about enough in these things, then it does sort of seems to not have a place. We do, having talked to the people who are writing this, it's not in there for a bad reason, if you know what I mean. It's just that the outcome still could be the same. So, and the same, if any of you responded to that ILC paper that DSS did as well, that was the same. Stuff that advocacy organisations do all the time wasn't even mentioned. So they talk about, in those developmental, preventative and corrective domains, advocacy, of course, is important in all of them. And so I suppose the most useful thing that any individual advocacy organisation can do will be to provide examples. Because you just have to realise that the bureaucrats that write these papers don't often meet a person with a disability. They certainly never get out and see the kind of client issues that advocates deal with or the community visitors see on the ground all the time. And the only way to make it clear to them is to give them short, snappy, clear examples of the kind of problems that people have. And in particular, there are parts of this paper that they will get good responses anyway from a range of people, in particular all the statutory bodies, will have people, you know, to write their responses. The last time I was down in Melbourne, I talked to somebody at the Office of the Public Advocate and at the Disability Services Commission about the way that they're responding. And all of those, the equivalents in the other states and territories will be doing the same thing. So they will hear from that side of the discussion. They'll hear from individuals and families about their issues, and they'll hear, of course, very strongly from service providers and what it is that they want. And interestingly, our sense is that the existing service providers, it's not in their interest, actually, for the system to be relaxed, because there is an argument that if you allow the choice and control properly for people, that will work if basically if people can use any service, anybody they want, you know, and just protected by consumer protection law, then that'll be the thing that'll make change. And they do want to encourage that for people who are self-managing. So as you read through this and see the questions, there's a separate set of questions around self-managing all the time, because they do want people who self-manage to have more choice and control, balanced with the protection that particularly vulnerable people need. But for the current service providers, of course, they'll protect their patch better if the existing quality systems and everything else have to apply to new players who come into the market as well. So they won't necessarily be arguing against us. The two areas in particular, though, that advocates and advocacy organisations have experience in and that they may not get the same responses from other people is restrictive practices and complaints. So restrictive practices, as they're only just starting the public consultations. I went to the first one they did was in Canberra last week, and there's a schedule. When you go on that engage.dss.gov.au, there's a schedule of whatever they call them, consultations. The Victorian, Robin said the one in Melbourne is middle... 15th of April. There will be at least one, maybe two others in somewhere else in Victoria, and I forgot to look. I'm not sure where. Does anybody know? Geelong on the 16th. Okay, so you can go on and register. Now, the one in Canberra was a really big thing. There were, you know, maybe 150 people or something at it. It was a big consultation. A big consultation, but actually the majority of people didn't speak. That's an interesting thing, and you know, that's just the way these things work. It is 3 hours long. They present a lot of information. We made some suggestions for how they could improve that the next time because they provided a huge amount of information and then asked questions, and people were dumbfounded as to how to even respond. But, you know, they're trying. So the things that advocates, the things that they know they're not in their consultations they've done already with organisations, restrictive practices when they talk to people, many people don't know anything about them. And advocates do, community visitors do. You know, obviously the senior practitioners and other people who approve them do. But it is a fairly small number of people who actually have any insight at all into restrictive practices. So the kind of things that you can tell them are, you know, when you go to visit a client and or, you know, you're in a group home for some reason, and the restrictive practices that you see in place that actually are not, they're not named up as restrictive practices. They're there, they're happening, but actually nobody has, you know, put in an application to get it approved because the staff don't even recognise that that's what it is. So there's the official restrictive practices that happen, and then there's all the other stuff that happens that you would recognise when you walk in the door, but that isn't named up. And, you know, I was talking to an advocate the other day who just sent me an email with a quick list, you know, a list of 15 things that she could quickly pick out from her previous last few weeks' work where she'd seen restrictive practices that she knows are not actually officially in place. So that's one thing which is important, because at the same time they're doing a piece of work where they've got a big consulting firm doing a whole lot of work on the data around this. But the data is only what's officially gathered and counted. And some of the stuff that you all know is some of the stuff that isn't counted, actually. And that includes the stuff which ends up kind of becoming hidden. It's there and it's happening, and it is actually it's the way people live within, you know, whose lives are constrained inside the sector. But the only way to get it to the attention of these people is for you to talk about it, really. And the same is true for complaints. So the Disability Services Commission will have, you know, data about complaints, and I know that the information and the statistics in Victoria are different from other places because of the kind of education role that the Commission here has played in the last few years. So the numbers of complaints, this is my understanding of it, the numbers of complaints have kept going up, because what it's demonstrating is that if you spend money on, you know, all those drink bottles with okay, it's okay to complain, and every time I, you know, I met anything in Victoria, I would see the posters and the fridge magnets and the whole thing. And over time, obviously, that is making enough of a difference that people are feeling that they can complain, that the same isn't happening necessarily in other places, which is why the Victorian data is different. But what we think, probably, is that there are still plenty of people who don't complain. And so having said I was going to ask you some questions, and now I haven't shut up, so I would like to just quickly ask you if you know, whoever wants to, can just tell me from your experience, what are the reasons you see that people don't make complaints?
Fear of intimidation, the number one, by ODSC.
So fear of intimidation by the staff. So they don't want to complain about the staff. Yeah.
Well, basically, yes.
Yep. Anybody else?
Can I add?
Yep.
I think, where do you begin?
Yeah.
Where do you begin? That's so much in your life is wrong that you could complain. Spend all day complaining. So where do you? How do you decide what you're going to complain about?
Yeah.
I think probably the belief that it will make a difference.
Uh huh.
I guess social isolation and lack of informal supports to assist a person to make a complaint.
I fear that the quality of care could drop further and they could actually die.
Yeah. Yep.
From my experience, people who have complained, it hasn't done anything.
Okay.
They only conciliate.
You're right.
Apathy.
Apathy on the part of the person or the people surrounding them? The
family.
The family, yeah, okay.
Got a roof
over
their head. The family member has got a roof over their head.
And picking up on what Christian said earlier when we were talking about violence, that people don't necessarily identify that their rights have been abused.
Yeah.
And also they don't want to go through the process of complaining, because they think it's too long and difficult to deal with.
So the process too long and difficult, which meaning, of course, that they don't think they'll get enough support to work through this process. Yep.
Complaining's exhausting. It's tiring.
Yep.
You have to pick your battles.
We find that people don't know that their services could be better. They just think that, yeah, it's bad, but that's kind of how all services are.
Yep.
People's complaints don't fit neatly under the legislative powers of the agency that they're complaining to.
Yep.
And you go, you know, when they complain to, say, the Office of Disability Service Commissioner, and then they get partway in and they go, well, actually, that's not in our legislative mandate. Or you've got a current complaint that's in process somewhere else, so therefore we can't, you know, that sort of stuff. I don't think makes sense to people who understand the bureaucratic system, but for consumers and families, it just feels like buck passing, and it feels like doors being closed, and, you know, all sorts of things.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because you know, there's opportunity in here. They ask questions about what kind of complaints systems should exist in the new national system, and that would make you think that whatever it is, it needs to sort of channel all the complaints need to be able to come in, and then within that system, they then refer them off to the right place. Yeah. Anybody else? Yep.
And I think another reason is that the disability sector per se, and I'm generalising, has a very poorly trained workforce, and that there is ignorance about what constitutes violence. And abuse. People say, oh, really? Is that abusive?
Mm.
So, yeah.
This year I've been assisting my daughter by directly employing support workers, and that's been life-changing, and that I've gone from being someone that has constantly complained about stuff to having now able to resolve those complaints one-to-one, face-to-face. It's life-changing. Mm. So my suggestion is direct employment and support people to do that.
Protectionism. These departments protect themselves from the complaint. So what you put in, they issue a void, dodge and weave and manoeuvre every which way to get out of it, whereas their policy says complaints are tools to service improvement.
Hmm. Yep, thanks, Tony.
And I'd like to second that.
Yep. One of the and one of the other particular things then, so that question was about why don't people complain, so the people who are the recipients of the services. What I'm interested in another thing, which is when, as an advocate, if you're working with someone on an issue and you think that it should be, so they haven't necessarily come to you, they've come to you to help resolve the issue, you know, but they're not necessarily pushing to make a complaint. As advocates, do you ever try and get them to make a complaint? Do you try and get them to make it formal, or do you just do be client directed and do whatever it is they want to do, which might be just make this problem go away, just sort it out? So I'm interested in trying to tease out some of that about what advocates can do to, you know, can they do anything about pushing up complaint rates?
Well, actually, as an advocate, that is our role. We give them the option, so it's up to them to choose whether they want to take that path. So, yeah, if they choose to, then we assist them to do that.
Yeah.
I'm probably a bit more proactive. I work with people with moderate to severe brain injury. So believing that they, you know, a person wants outcome X, and if there's a barrier, and the way of removing that barrier is to lodge a complaint or a challenge to a bureaucracy or service provider, I believe it's my job to do that.
Yeah. We work with people from non-English speaking backgrounds, and a lot of the times they're not actually aware of their rights, and as advocates, all we can do is make them aware.
Yeah.
But at the same time, when they do know about these complaint procedures, they are often afraid that the service would be taken away, or they would be punished in some way or the other. So that is a difficulty we face as well.
With the work that we do, it could provide self-advocacy. Therefore, we want to empower people to recognize and to acknowledge that there is a problem. There is an issue. And then after they acknowledge, they've got the right to complain.
Someone else down there. This is immensely useful for me, and it's what it's reaffirming for me is all you know, as any one of you says something, everybody else around the room nods, because this is the bread and butter of advocacy, and everybody here knows that this is actually the reality. It's hard to get that through to people who don't live and breathe it. And so the only way we can get that through is really putting in submissions, and, you know, you don't have to pay any attention at all to any of the questions they've asked if you don't want to, if it's too distracting. Just put in, from the experience of your clients and the advocacy work you do, what the problems are, and you know, if you can think of the solutions, good, think, suggest any good solutions you can think of, or anything, any glimmer of hope, anything that you see that works better for some reason, you know, or any strategy that any organisation has taken that you think works, do put it in, because they are looking for this stuff. But this exact stuff that you're talking about here is the unspoken, the hidden stuff. It's not, you know, they kind of know it in theory, but they don't really. And so therefore, all they will get and understand is the data that their consultancy firm that they're spending a lot of money on will get the data that's counted, and they won't get any of this stuff unless you tell them. Yep, sorry.
My experience is that people are afraid of the process. They're also tired of telling their story over and over. So, you know, often I might be encouraging somebody to complain, and they're nervous about it. If they say no, definitely not, sure. But I try and offer maximum level of support to the person to say, I'll come to the meeting with you. I'll take notes. I'll tell as much of the story as you want me to, and try and fill in the gap if that would mean that they're prepared to complain.
Yep.
The other thing too, I think, is that people are afraid of the formal process, but if they know they're not happy about something and they want something done about it, then it kind of doesn't really matter what you call that. If you approach the service with that person and together you say what it is they're unhappy about and ask for change, then you are complaining.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so I think you can get a little bit hung up on whether or not you've complained. I think it's about whether or not you've made your point and told them that you're unhappy and demanded that they fix it.
Yeah. Yep. And the other thing is then, do you have any sense of those complaints that people do take to their, and probably just specifically to service providers about their issues, how many of them get resolved satisfactorily? That's any percentages. What do people think? How do you, you know, do half of them get resolved satisfactorily? 70%, 80%, 10%? What's your guesstimate? It's quite depressing. So quite small percentages people are...
Very, very small. And you know about it when it goes well because, boy, do you celebrate.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing, of course. In advocacy, there's very few wins. And what does that mean? Does that mean that people just go back to whatever the situation was and they put up with it? Or they manage to find something else, you know, some other solution.
Yeah. Look, it's my experience that some of the best parent advocates are really isolated and blacklisted by the services, and there's a real divide and rule so that they can no longer rally support amongst other individuals and parents who are experiencing the same sort of thing. They're really isolated. So for those people who are quite good at complaining and who are probably at the forefront of some systemic and service reform, pay incredibly high price personally, and potentially so do their sons and daughters in terms of reprisals at all sorts of ways that I could bore you to death.
No, that's interesting. And in particular, actually, I had a parent ring me. We, at Dana, we're a peak body. We don't get many phone calls directly from individuals, but a parent from Sydney rang the other day, and it was half an hour before I could get a word in, not a single word, but about the desperate education issue that he's trying to deal with for his son. But it reminded me, because he's in that situation of being a very active parent advocate for his son, and what that means is the school, the principal, the teachers, the education system now is lined up against him, because he's now become a challenge to them. I felt terrible, really. What I ended up doing, I found myself, what I discovered I was doing in the conversation, I was trying to get him to think through what outcome he wanted, because he was gone to the UN and doing all this other stuff, and I'm thinking, oh God, you know, your son, he's only in grade 8, he still needs to be at school, you know, pull back a bit and try and, you know, but, you know, and I mean, I'm the one that should be advocating for him to do all that stuff, but it's hard for people to separate what they need to achieve. Yeah, George.
We actually find that we have a lot of positive outcomes, and that we actually do support young people to get often what they want out of that situation. Yep. One thing that I've learned in the 10 years I've been doing this is the power of advocacy to achieve an outcome. Because if people go to a service provider and that provider knows they have an advocate, you'd be amazed how different they often respond when they know there's someone there that knows the legislation, that knows that person has rights and it's going to stand by them until they sort it out. So we need to tell NDIS that advocacy is hugely needed and that it should not be watered down.
Yep, and that's interesting. We've pointed that out to them, that preventative domain that they talk about in there, just having an advocate involved with somebody actually is preventative. And some, you know, every advocate kind of has examples of where they're going to go to a meeting with someone and actually when they get there, it's all fixed and it's resolved. The advocate doesn't even have to open their mouth because the threat of having the advocate there has actually made them find a solution.
It's just about having something on a letterhead that says, you know, that shows that you know that the person has rights,
yeah.
that it can turn around. And one of the things that concerns me is that, you know, the NDIS is not going to recognise that people need that, particularly people who have little or no speech or who are young people who aren't able to necessarily speak up for themselves.
Yeah.
Yes, my concern is for, when we talk about safeguards, those people whose issues never even get to an advocate. What safeguards will we have for them?
Yeah.
That's a huge concern. I'm in the Geelong area, Barwon, and there were so many people made ineligible for the NDIS, but none or very few have actually appealed that. So educating people about their rights is huge. We really need to. The ones that have managed to appeal have pretty much won their cases, so it's really important that people know their rights and their process.
All right, we'll wind up. I think that has been enormously useful for me, and we will try and put together some kind of survey structure that you can have a bit of an input to the thing that we'll be putting together. But I would encourage you all, if you have time to do it, the submissions for this Quality and Safeguarding Framework close on the 30th of April. But you will get a chance to go to those meetings, you know, make sure you say what you think at them, and maybe consciously focus on what are the stuff that advocates know that won't otherwise get in here, because it's a bit different from actually some of the questions they're asking. Okay, thanks very much for that. That was great.
Thank you, Mary. That was really valuable. And for those of us who are here today, but those who are listening on the audio recording, we will endeavour to make sure that the audio recording of this particular session and the written transcript of it are made available as soon as possible, so that if you are actually putting together a submission into both the Senate inquiry but also the NDIA Quality and Frameworks, Quality and Safeguarding Frameworks document, that you can take advantage of some of the conversation that's happened today. So do look out on the Diary website in the resource page under the Advocacy Sector Conversations Forum page for that information. However, because you've registered today, you'll also get an email from Natasha when we've updated that page, so you don't have to look too hard for that. Now, I've just got to quickly find my spot. In fact, what I'm about to speak about very much relates to the discussion that we've just had. And as I get older, I find that I can't multitask and I can't talk and find my space in my brow notes, so I'm just going to... Yay, found it. So I think the two, Mary's session and what I'm about to embark upon, I think are very closely linked, and we didn't plan it that way, though. Key messages about disability advocacy. It's so important, as Mary pointed out, that when bureaucrats and government departments are reviewing submissions and consultation processes and research data, they might not necessarily have a good grounding or an appreciation in the day-to-day work of disability advocacy, in the day-to-day experience of people with a disability. So it is our role to be able to point that out. And it's easier said than done. Whenever I have conversations with people that... everyone in this room, when I speak to other disability advocates, we all say that it's really clear what the role and the value is of disability advocacy. But how do you summarise that in 30 seconds? How do you state that in a lift conversation when you happen to get the minister's advisor, or when John Fain or one of his production staff are in the lift with you, and or you're, you know, waiting for your coffee at Starbucks, etc.? It's very challenging to be able to do that. So what we did at Daru is late last year, we held a forum of executive officers of Victorian government or Office for Disability funded disability advocacy organisations, and we invited the executive officers or their delegates to come along to that forum to basically, one, all be under the same roof and have an opportunity to talk about what are the issues of concern that they have. And two, given that we're getting some information about various inquiries and investigations into abuse and neglect of people with disability, and given we're hearing about various service providers and their neglect of clients, and given that we're hearing about community sector organisations losing funding, might be losing funding, having to tender for business when they've never had to bid before, we thought that it might be a good opportunity again to hold a forum to enable executive officers and or their delegates to express what their concerns might be. With the view that Daru, given that we are funded to be a resource for the disability advocacy sector, might find out what could we do. Is there anything by way of resourcing disability advocacy organisations that might enable some movement forward? The result of that forum was that a working group was formed with two primary goals, really. One was to be able to go out and sell the great value and role that disability advocacy plays in safeguarding the rights of people with disabilities here in Victoria. And that we would, given that the forum was held the week after the Victorian state election, it was an opportunity that we could maybe package up together some messages and sell that to the new Victorian government and therefore get a little bit more of a polished presentation together, or polished package of messages about the role of disability advocacy. And the other aim was therefore to develop up key messages. So we formed a working group, and some of those working group members are here in the room today. Actually, I haven't seen Melanie Muir. I don't know if she was registered to come today, but I'm not sure if she actually has attended today. But a name who would be very familiar to all of us, George Dalapouros, is on that working group. We had a couple of members from VicRAN, the Victorian Rural Advocacy Network, and Women with Disabilities Victoria, and Pauline Williams from AMIDA, who is in the room today, is a part of that working group as well. And we had some representation from Brain Injury Matters and the Self-Advocacy Resource Unit as well. So we all formulated, we all got together and formulated a terms of reference for what our goals would be, and started to work on what our key messages might be. Again, easier said than done. So we've then engaged a marketing or a media marketing company called Media Maneuvers, who basically are made up of a group of journalists who train mainly corporates, and we got a really nice non-corporate rate for the consultancy, and we worked with Media Maneuvers to develop up some key messages. Now, a very, very draft form and a very small form of those key messages is in the package that you got when you entered the room today. We've deliberately only inserted three key messages, and I'll take you through them in a moment. But they're called push statements, if that helps you to find the right document in your package. I deliberately selected a push statement around women and disabilities just purely because of the morning session today, really. And so I'll take you through that in a moment. But what our plan is to develop up a toolkit so that disability advocacy organisations can utilise that toolkit for when they are going and speaking to media, when they're speaking to government ministers, department heads, opposition advisors, secretaries of departments, etc., to sell the value of disability advocacy. Media manoeuvres suggested to us that it's really, really important that you have really short, sharp, succinct messages. And even though every sector has its jargon, and boy does disability have its jargon, it's really important to try and not have your key messages be statements that utilise the jargon of the sector, because that then alienates you from the people that you're trying to influence. So when you do read through the push statements that we've actually provided in your package, be mindful of that. Now, the model that Media Manoeuvres suggests we use is called the PUSH model, P-U-S-H. P standing for point, U standing for underpinning, as in underpinning message, S as in so what, and H for hammer at home. Now, when they talk about point, it's what's your specific point that you're trying to sell? What's the essence of your message? And usually your point is in relation to some kind of a question. So we were trying to simulate in those sheets that you're looking at, that one of the key messages that we, disability advocacy organisations and disability advocates, need to be selling is, you know, what is the role of disability advocacy? Why should government continue to fund it? And so we need to be able to have some statements that respond succinctly to that question. But then we also need to have underpinning statements that are an evidence base, that cite some statistics, cite some research, give some evidence that backs up why we're making that point. So that's the U in PUSH. And then the S is for so what. So what does that mean? So if government should fund disability advocacy, and why should it do that? And so what does that mean for the community? What does that mean for people with a disability? And then the H in PUSH is to hammer it home. So pick a key point and then hammer it home. Now, I remember when I was getting trained by the media trainer at Media Manoeuvres about this, that I said, you don't really need a H, do you? But as we discovered in our working group, if you didn't have a H, it would not be a very good acronym. So the H is there purely, in my opinion, to make it a much better sounding acronym. But it's a good point that when you listen to good media interviews, and in fact today on AM, on Radio National, I didn't get the name of the person who spoke, but it was the CEO of a homelessness service, which has just been announced. Scott Morrison has just announced that they will be getting 2 years renewal funding, despite earlier being told that they were not going to get that funding. And I noticed that in her messaging back to the journalist, she was hammering home a point very, very clearly, which was, without mental health, housing and homelessness services, we know people will die. Now, that's a pretty powerful message, and it's straightforward and simple and packs a punch. So our aim in developing these push statements, these key messages about disability advocacy, is that we can make as succinct a statement like that so that disability advocates and disability advocacy organisations, when being interviewed by the media, when selling our message to influencers, we're really, really clear on that. So today is really... can you get a... George, do you want to get a microphone?
because we spent all the time on these, didn't we, Robin?
Oops, I think we've had an accident over to my left. I think it might be rude for you to proceed, George. Can you make that comment again?
I was going to say that, it's all about getting attention and being remembered. And, saying that without disability advocacy, people will die, that might have worked well as well. So maybe we need to feed that one into their...
I think so. I think it's a work in progress getting this toolkit up and going. Our aim is that by the end of April we'll have the full toolkit ready. But we just thought, given today and the nature of this audience, it would be good for you to have a look at the beginning stages of this toolkit. Because, again, when Mary was speaking, I was thinking... I had started to draft a push statement around... what role does disability advocacy play in safeguarding the rights of people with disabilities? And I thought, well, it just got too complex. It turned into an essay. And how we sell things so that they are short and sharp is really the key. So I think I take heart, George, in your comment that perhaps, without disability advocacy, people would die. It's true, isn't it? In certain circumstances, it could be the outcome. So let's take ourselves very, very seriously. I want to thank the working group who did come together to put the beginnings of this toolkit together. The working group are still meeting, and we will be working for the next month or so to really fine-tune a few more statements. I, in particular, want to develop push statements around all of the systemic advocacy areas that are itemised in the QDC data collection that we do. Those of you who are disability advocacy organisations that are funded through the Office for Disability, and we are required to complete that quarterly data collection form. And there are the systemic advocacy areas, education, employment, abuse, neglect, etc. We're planning to develop push statements around all of those areas as well, and gathering a lot more statistics and evidence there. So that's our... key messages about disability advocacy toolkit. Any comments on what you have seen, and any comments about any key messages that you think it would be good for the working group to further develop?
Jack's speaking. I think one of your first points about when developing a message for the media, having it in language that isn't in sector language is really important. I know me and Jenny were talking about that in the break as well. And it's also really important to make the disability sector more accessible for people with disabilities, to find ways about talking about our issues and our lives in ways that still give us a voice and make what we're saying powerful and important, but don't further create this kind of barrier in terms of the way that the sector speaks about people with disabilities, and how do we translate what we're actually saying to the broader community and our issues.
Thank you. That is a really key point, isn't it? Because it's one thing to alienate the people you're trying to influence, but it's another thing to alienate the people you're trying to support and help. Good point. Thanks.
My comment is really just supporting what Jax has just said, really. And for me, some of that was evident today in the presentations, that some of the language was just too sector-focused and too convoluted. And I guess what comes across to me is, one, I've got a struggle to understand. It's like I'm doing my interpretation in my head. What is it really saying? But also it causes you, I think, there's a disengagement in the real issues for me. There's a lack of passion, and there's a lack of the real issue once you get into that kind of communication. So I would say this is great. You know, don't just use it for push statements, media, marketing, selling thing, but it just should be the way in which we communicate services or whatever's being done, really.
Great, thank you. Sorry, any other comments? Or?
Yeah, just put back, yeah. Look, when you do, I'm assuming that you're going to put this into the government space as well, in terms of why should advocacy be funded in the future? My question is sort of, how will you target who in the government this goes to? Because I know the government space is quite large, and to get your point across, you'll need to target this to quite a select number of people within that space. Mm. So I guess it's important to make sure that you target these push numbers into the right spaces. Mm. And where would those spaces be?
Okay. That's a really, really good point, and I suppose I have a two-pronged answer to that. And the first is, because this will be developed up as a toolkit that disability advocacy organisations then utilise to supplement their campaigning or their advocacy. And so it's not the be-all and end-all of any campaigning or approach to government. That's answer number one. Answer number two is that is something that's in the terms of reference of the working group to actually look at targeting these messages to certain people within government and opposition, and we just haven't got to that step yet in our planning. So it's really good to have that reinforcement here from the floor that it's pretty critical that we are very targeted in our approach. One of the things that I need to be mindful about, though, is that DARU is... we're not a policy maker, we're not a lobbyist, we're not a campaigner. We provide and just create, develop, maintain, build resources for the sector. So that's why we're wanting to create a resource that then the sector can utilise.
Mark Gale, I think it's got to be a core question, isn't it? What is advocacy and why is it important? And there's got to be a message that addresses that. And I think one of the difficulties we have is that the big issue holding back people with disability historically is being denied a voice. And the disability rights movement for a long time has been asserting, listen, you know, nothing about us without us, listen to us, treat us as adults, be guided by what we think and say and want, you know, respect our human rights. And then we got alongside that an advocacy tradition because people with disability have been denied a voice. And we're at this kind of crossroads, I think, where we kind of want advocacy to be redundant, but know that that time is a long way off yet. And so what we've got to do is accept the legitimacy of advocacy, that it's still needed, it's still really important, that it's not about denying people with disability a voice themselves, it's about being alongside that and standing alongside and supporting. So we've got this tricky twin message of respect the rights and dignity of people with disability, and advocacy is a way of helping ensure that comes about, which is too long for what you're looking for.
Yes.
So we've got to, you know, kind of leave half of it out and accept the good faith of advocacy, that it's not about supplanting the disability rights movement. It's about supporting it, being alongside it. So disability gives people is independent voice for people with disability. It's about promoting the rights, dignity, interest of people with disability. It's independent. They've got to be the core messages. So if you can bundle that up.
Great.
and then hammer it home at the end.
Thanks, Mark. That's really good. And interestingly, I mean, I think you've really summarised what's been the challenge for the working group, because, and again, this is my take on things, part of the role of advocacy is to be anonymous. You know, it's to support someone to stand up for their own rights and make complaints and empower themselves. So a good advocate doesn't necessarily want to broadcast who they are and what they do. And yet we're at this critical point in our history when it comes to the funding of specific disability, you know, supports, where if we don't speak up, we risk the function of independent disability advocacy in Australia not being going unrecognised. So it is that, you know.
Can nuance. I just tag on? You just prompted me. I mean, there's a real risk with the NDIS that it's kind of seen as the end of advocacy. Don't need it because it's just consumer choice. Mm. And so this is a really critical juncture moment.
Yeah. And that's why, as Mary said, this is the time when we have to speak up about the specific stories, the specific issues, because if we don't, it won't get counted.
Yeah. The question actually that I will be asking community in general, and even all our government at different level, it will be how much everybody want people with a disability to be part of the community and have the same opportunity in life, like everyone. I will be asking this question because this question is very much connecting with the role of advocacy. So, if you have a powerful disability advocacy system in place, then we will be able to achieve the equality in the community. Otherwise, without advocacy, well, people with a disability will become invisible.
Okay. Can you turn that into a question so that we can then try and write a push statement? And you can either do it, you know, think about it now and let me know before the end of the day, or email me. Honestly, yeah, because I think that's the challenge. Like, we've got to find ways to turn these into questions that we then give responses to. So that's great, yeah. So I'll give you more work, Chris. I'll buy you a drink. Yes. I'm just mindful that I want to try and keep things to finishing on time, and we need to hear from Michael Cromie. So can someone just give me an indication of how many other people have hands in the air and want to make a statement or question? Two. All right. So that's you people with your hands up are the last ones. Thank you.
Okay. Just the million-dollar question, as far as we're concerned, is with particularly in Victoria, where the care policy standards and values are huge, absolutely massive, up this high, and advocacy would appear to be fighting the disconnection between service intent and service delivery.
Mm.
So that The disconnection between service intent and service delivery is what we're really fighting. And why should we be fighting that? Because mainly bloody-minded bureaucracy.
Thank you.
Well, that's good, Tony, because that gives me a question. And the question is there a, I've forgotten the word you just used, you know, is there a disparity between disability service intent? Okay. I'm going to listen back to the recording. I'm tired. Is there a disparity between the intent of disability services and the role of disability advocacy? Something to that effect. I can turn that into a question. So thank you.
Robin, this is great that you're doing this work, and if you could manage to do a push statement about why Mitch Fifield should fund a peak for disability advocacy, that would be great.
we'll try.
One of the things just to for you to think about while you're trying to do these messages, that it's such an odd, peculiar time for advocacy at the minute. So there's huge uncertainty about the funding of advocacy as state and territory governments are all deciding whether they're going to continue to fund advocacy or how or to what extent. Federal government will continue, but you know we don't know if they'll put any more money into it. And there's another peculiar thing happening that we know little bits about and we don't know enough about yet to deal with it properly. There's this kind of almost splintering of the functions of advocacy. So when you were talking, Robin, about you trying to think about what advocacy does. Well, so advocacy as it's practiced in Australia has been around for about 30 years. There's a fairly consistent way of advocates work fairly in a kind of integrated, holistic kind of way with a person with a disability, whatever the issue is, and then they work with them to get a resolution, and they use a whole lot of strategies to do that. So what's happening now, the NDIS is going to pay for supported decision-making in some way. We don't know yet at what rate or exactly which organisations will be able to do it. We're assuming at the moment that advocacy organisations will be able to get funded to do that, but that's not clear. That's being worked on. There may be some talk about safeguarding supports or safeguarding stuff that happens elsewhere. In the UK, they have a sort of a system now about that. So there's something that feels like it's happening, and it's not yet at the stage. I had a discussion on the phone the other day with one of the DSS people who said this stuff isn't yet ready for them to talk to outsiders. And which is quite, I think, is quite funny, but I understand what he means. All of us are the outsiders, so we're the people, and all of you are the people who do the work. But from the inside of a system, you're the outsiders. So if we just put that to one side and get past it, what it means is there will be at some stage later this year there will be some kind of opportunity for us to think about and work with what's being developed. But my worry sort of that what I can feel that's being developed is what the practice of advocacy as it exists in Australia may end up somehow being divided off into little segments. And I'm not sure, that could be a terrible thing and it could be a good thing. It's a good thing if what it means is there's an opportunity for advocacy organisations to get funded to do specific pieces of the work. You know, get funded to do, so they continue to do their general level advocacy, and then separately they can apply, you know, for individual clients through the NDIS for those participants to do supported decision making with them. Or, you know, if the safeguarding thing turns into something that I can't envision what that could be exactly, and I other than glancing at the UK stuff, I haven't had time to kind of properly look at it. But it may be that there'll be additional sources of ways to do advocacy work, but it might not be. It might end up being that that advocacy becomes this little tiny bits and pieces, and that small under-resourced advocacy organisations are in a worse situation than they would be now, where instead of just doing the work with your source of funding, you might have to apply and get the same pathetic amount of money, but do it through several sources. I don't know. It's a huge thing that's sitting around the advocacy sector at the minute. So yes, go ahead and get these push messages as clear as you can, because you know we're going to need them at every level, I think.
Thanks for the endorsement, Mary. Thank you. Let me wrap up this session by thanking Robin Gale for from the Disability Advocacy Resource Unit, and thanking Mary Mallett, for CEO of DANA. I really appreciate, Mary, you taking the time to come to today to the forum, but to share with us your wisdom, but also to gather from us the wisdom that's in this room. So thank you, Mary. Thank you. Thank you, Robin.